Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel is Dr. Tim Brookins, Associate Professor of Classics at Houston Baptist University. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here, David. Yeah. Good to see you again.
Good to see you as well. We're going to talk about your book entitled Corinthian Wisdom, Stoic Philosophy, and the Ancient Economy. It's a part of the Society for New Testament Studies monograph series, number 159, just in case people are looking up. Yeah. It's published by Cambridge University Press. Congratulations for it.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
It's a great book. I've had a chance to read it over the last couple of weeks, and I was hoping to get to it a little sooner, but COVID, you know.
COVID, yeah.
COVID. It's the excuse for everything.
Everything is COVID.
Everything is COVID. Yeah. Okay.
That's why I was late today.
That's why you're late. Now, we're surrounded by books. We've got commentaries here. We've got dictionaries. We've got a variety of things. This is called a monograph. What is a monograph exactly?
Yeah, so a monograph is a book that's written primarily for an academic audience of specialists and is dedicated to one particular topic and is written from beginning to end normally by one author.
And a lot of times there's a sustained argument right through the book. There's a thesis or a key idea.
Exactly.
I tell students, every good book, every important book has a big idea. So what's the big idea of your book here?
Yeah, well, you look at the title, and at first I think you might ask, what do these three things have to do with each other? Corinthian wisdom, Stoic philosophy, ancient economy.
Yeah.
The basic purpose of the book is to try to make a reconstruction of the situation that occasioned Paul's first letter to the Corinthian church.
Okay.
And looking at the initial chapters of the letter, it looks like the church is divided, and they're divided primarily because of some brand of wisdom that some in the church have adopted. And Paul describes this wisdom in various ways, but one term he uses is the wisdom of the world. And he responds by saying that this is counter to the wisdom of the cross. And so when you compare the two, what he's saying is that this wisdom of the world that they've adopted is a wisdom that promotes the self. And in their case, that created divisions in the church by creating status distinctions between those who were superior or wise and those who were inferior or were at a lower level of spiritual achievement. And I argue in the book that their view, this brand of wisdom that some have adopted, is an adaptation of Stoic philosophy.
Okay, now you're going to have to define that for a lot of folks. Stoicism seems to be unemotionalism, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it, for good reason, that particular word sticks. But in the ancient world, Stoic philosophy and Stoic ideas are sort of just everywhere, aren't they?
Exactly. It was the most successful of the ancient philosophies, in some ways, maybe the most successful philosophy of all time in the ways it's been appropriated since. But, you know, in addition to the kind of dispassionate teaching, the idea was that Stoicism could offer you a life that guaranteed happiness now. And so they had this ideal figure that they called the wise man. And the wise man is the person who had perfected human existence. By using the God-given rational faculty of reason, we all have, and it's actually a portion of divinity that lives in each one of us that enables us out of our own power to live in a way that is perfect, where we've reached complete virtue. And in that way, bring to realization the kind of divinity that is within each one of us.
So every person has a spark of divinity in a sense.
Yeah, you might not have known it.
But you might not have known about it. Is that called logos by any chance?
It is, yes. The word, of course, they use the word logos. They use the word theos or God. Lots of different terms they use to describe this ultimate divinity. But one of the terms they use is logos, and it's usually translated reason, and that is the term that's used of Jesus in John 1.
So this character that we meet early in the book of Corinthians, the First Corinthians, called the wise man, one of the things you say there is this: he's not really a sophist, he's a Stoic. And so that's a part of it. So what's the other argument? What's the other side of it that in fact he's not a Stoic, but he's a sophist?
Yeah, so through the history of interpretation, there have been lots of ideas given as to what this kind of wisdom was that the Corinthians had adopted. And starting in the 1990s, there was a very popular thesis that was very successful for at least 15 years until this book was published.
Your book, yeah, and no. you sort of dismantled completely. That piece by piece. Yeah.
Yeah. And the argument was that wisdom was, of course, about eloquence, the kind of skill that an orator would have, because the ancient school curriculum was designed from beginning to end to create somebody who could speak well.
Stand up in front of a crowd,
and
be persuasive and mm-hmm. be attractive physically.
Right, yeah.
Well, all of that mattered, right?
Yeah, so arguing in the courts, arguing in the Senate House, as a governor, say, of a province, you know, addressing the public, writing a diplomatic letter. So all of education was really designed to create statesmen. Mm. And so the argument that has been made is that wisdom obviously has to do with what education was all about, which is about oratory, speaking well. And so from there, looking at 1:10 through 12, where Paul first introduces the problem. It says, you guys are divided, and some of you say, I'm of Paul and I'm of Apollos. The thesis ran that Apollos was a great orator, because in the book of Acts, he's introduced as an Alexandrian Jew who was very learned, and sometimes the word used there is translated as eloquent. Mm. Where Paul, by contrast, in 2 Corinthians 10:10, says that other people say that his appearance is weak and that his speech is contemptible. And so putting those two little descriptions together, the argument is that the Corinthians were enamored with Apollos because he had the wisdom of eloquence, and they preferred him to this Paul person who was really quite unimpressive, particularly when it came to eloquence.
Yeah, we don't really know anything about their physical presence, do we? Have them described exactly at that particular time. One of the things I really like about the book is the fact that you don't look to just one or two passages to try to help sort of structure this. You look through the whole book, right? You from beginning to end, you sort of look at the Stoic ideas that are a part of culture at that time and see how those are reflected there. But one of the things you talk about is how mirror readings, the whole idea of mirror readings, can be helpful, but also can be send us down the wrong trail. What is a mirror reading exactly?
Yeah, so when we read Paul's letters, we're reading somebody else's mail. Right.
Yep. Yep.
They know why Paul is saying what he's saying, but we don't, because we don't know the backstory. And so there are certain things that are just assumed in the letter that he knows the audience will understand, but that we don't because we are not part of the situation. And so mirror reading happens when we look at Paul's side of the conversation and try to reflect from that back to the original situation, say what the Corinthians believed that Paul is now responding to. And so one of the ways we mirror read the situation, one of the ways that we have done this in the past, is by taking Paul's antithetical formulation. So where he says, you know, God's wisdom is not like this. We take that to mean Paul is stating exactly the opposite of what his audience believed.
Gotcha.
And so, of course, that can be accurate in places, but we can't necessarily conclude that every time he uses antithetical formula that it's opposite to that his view is opposite to that of his audience.
Right. So that he knows what they're saying, and he's saying, well, let me tell you how it really is, in a sense. And that mirror reading can take us down the right path in some cases. I use it from time to time in the classroom and in reading text, but there are other times that, well, not so fast. We don't want to be too aggressive with that, I suppose. Scholarship is very faddish. Right. I mean, one of the things you were talking about is 15 years ago or mid-90s, that was a very popular idea. But somebody writes an impressive book about rhetorical criticism or something, then everybody has to jump on that bandwagon and become rhetorical critics. Same thing, if somebody writes an important book about social history, then everybody has to sort of get on the social history thing. But what I sense you're doing is trying to get some balance to all that, to draw from the best of those ideas. And just not sort of just say, well, we're all in on this one thing. Is that a fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And one thing that any work of scholarship has to do is it has to respect the fact that somebody else has already said something about this.
Yeah.
And you can't just ignore it, right?
Right.
Because they're all smart people and there's always going to be some legitimacy to what everybody's saying.
Well, one way to diss somebody or to just ignore what they've said, right? Say, well, that's
not even worth
a footnote or anything. Uh-huh. But in fact, that's a part of what scholarship is. It takes into consideration all these things, even if you disagree with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think what you're alluding to is part of the title that says the ancient economy.
right.
And you mentioned a little bit earlier the social historical approach to reading the letter. So starting in the late 70s and on through the 80s, there was a line of interpretation that came to be known as the New Consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was, well, in prior decades, we considered the early Christian movement to be a movement primarily of the oppressed, the lower classes, the poor, slaves. But the New Consensus came along and said, well, no, actually, there's evidence for some well-to-do people in some of Paul's churches, particularly the Corinthian church.
Mm.
And since then, we've refined that language a little bit more. When we say well-to-do, we don't mean elite.
The 1%.
The 1%. We don't know of anybody.
The millionaires and the billionaires, right?
Yeah, none of those people. But people who are upper middling level, mm-hmm. right? And so it would be hard to compare them today, but maybe like a university professor or something.
Right? Yeah. Well educated and probably making a little more money than your average Joe Sixpack, as the political line goes.
And so in that respect, you know, I have to pay attention to that mm-hmm. there seemed, the evidence is good that there were some people in the Corinthian church that were a little bit elevated in status in comparison to other people in the church and to people in Paul's other churches. And so the argument I make is that these folks may have had access to philosophical education,
mm-hmm.
which is something that was not covered extensively in early school curriculum, but is something that as you went on as a literate person, you would dabble in, say, reading handbooks that kind of gave in more concise form what the philosophies were about.
Mm. So right now, the idea is, it seems to be, is that there is a greater stratification in society than just the haves and the have-nots, the two sort of the upper echelon, the 1%, 1, 2, 3%, mm-hmm. and then everybody else is sort of in the middle of that, and everybody else is poor. But yeah, I think it's right to conclude that Paul's letters maybe had a majority of people, because two-thirds of the people were in the lower echelon,
right?
Didn't have as much education, didn't have as much money, free money to do things with. Were not necessarily living at a subsistence level, but as we were talking earlier, the whole idea of what it means to be poor is very much regional, isn't it? I mean, a person who is poor in one place is not necessarily poor in another place. When we look at our own,
Texas versus California.
That's a good example, right?
Texas income in Los Angeles doesn't get you quite as far.
It doesn't get you very far, does it? So, I mean, all these things, in fact, are regional. But it's a very stratified society, and that really is reflected in the letter, isn't it? And particularly in that passage where it seems the Lord's Supper is being not practiced in a way that was consistent with Jesus or Paul, either one, right?
Right. Yeah. That's one passage that the New Consensus people pointed to as evidence for that stratification in the Corinthian church. And it makes a lot of sense. You say your church has to meet somewhere and they don't have a church building. Mm-hmm. They're meeting primarily in homes. Of course, there may be other contexts that where they could have met. But Paul mentions house churches often.
Mm-hmm.
And in his letter to the Romans, when he's writing from Corinth, he mentions that he's staying in the house of Gaius. And so, looking at the socioeconomic level of those more elevated members of the church, we can suppose that perhaps they had homes of their own, some of them.
Mm-hmm. And instead of living in an apartment or tenement.
An apartment, especially rented quarters.
Right, right.
And those would have played host to the church. Now, they wouldn't have had mansions, right? Because we're not talking about the top 1%. These would be modest villas. And the way that the home was set up, you had what was called a triclinium in a traditional Roman villa. that, you know, have a three-sided dining table, basically. But the seating was very limited. Could seat something like 12 to 15 people. Now, if you have a church that consists of 40 to 50 people, you can't all practice the Lord's feast together. If that's what's going on, we're not exactly sure if they were having a feast with the Lord's Supper. But if they were, you know, we would have people sitting out in the atrium to eat, right? They'd go through the line, maybe, you know, fill up their plates with whatever was left and sit in the atrium. And so who would have sat in the triclinium? More likely the friends of the host.
Yes.
Who was one of the
more well-to-do.
Well-to-do.
Yeah. And you know, I've seen this myself. Of course, you have too, in academic circles where certain scholars, you know, will attract more attention and because of the books that they've written or the places they've taught, those kind of things. There's this kind of honor society that's going on in pretty much every place. One of the things I love about your book is the fact that you think about and give some thought to the slogans that the Corinthians and how Paul's representing those. Mm-hmm. Can we take a look at a couple of those?
Sure.
It's on page 92 of your book, Corinthian Wisdom, Stoic Philosophy, and the Ancient Economy. There are a variety of slogans, and we can take whichever one you're interested in. But I particularly am drawn to the one that starts in chapter 7, beginning verse 1, and if you don't mind just kind of translating and reading that, but that's the section of the letter where Paul, it seems, takes up their letter that has come to him, where they're posing questions to him, and he's reflecting back some of the things that they're saying in their letter. Chapter 7, verse 1.
Yeah, so it's believed by many that Paul writes his letter based on two sources, right? In the first chapter, he says, Chloe's people tell me that you guys are divided. And so we have these first four chapters, and then 5 and 6 seem very closely related. Mm-hmm. But then in 7:1, he says, now concerning what you wrote, which suggests that there's also another source of information, and it's actually a letter from the Corinthian church. And then he goes on, apparently, to quote from their letter, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And so it looks like this is one of the so-called Corinthian slogans, which are introduced at various places in the letter, but generally are not explicitly ascribed to the Corinthians. So in other words, Paul doesn't always say, you guys say, and then quote them.
You said.
Yeah, because they know what they said.
Right, right.
But there are no quotation marks in Greek either.
Right.
Originally, and so
some people have taken that as that's what Paul is teaching.
Yes,
I'm teaching that it's good for a man not to touch a woman or have sexual relations with a woman. Right, that's how it's taken.
Right,
but in fact, there were apparently some people in Corinth who were advocating kind of marital celibacy at that point.
Right, and it's this is an interesting chapter 7, where he deals with celibacy, but in the context of discussion of marriage and whether marriage is good. And it's kind of an outlier, you know, with respect to my thesis, because
it
looks like what's going on with a lot of the other slogans is they're actually saying, because the body doesn't matter, I can do what I want with it, including sleep with prostitutes, eat whatever food I want. Whereas here, they're actually taking the opposite approach. They're saying it's good for a man not to touch a woman. So it's very possible that the letter came from a faction in the church that was responding to the wise men. They were concerned about what the wise men were teaching and now inquired of Paul about it. Mm. Like, this is our view, and this does not seem to be what these people believe.
Yeah. So your book's been out a while. Mm-hmm. It's not hot off the presses, but it's been out a while. How have critics engaged it? What have been the response?
Well, it's been pretty extensively cited in terms of the sheer numbers. Mm. Hasn't been engaged at much depth in most of the literature. The reviews that have come out on it have been positive. One review that came out with the Review of Biblical Literature said, this is the new thing, and everybody has to respond to it now in further, you know, conversation with this. But generally, it's just cited as Brookins says this, or there is this view, without any kind of evaluation. Yeah. Although I have been in touch with some who are continuing to work in this area. And there was a master's thesis that was recently completed at St. Andrews University that builds on this.
Builds on this whole idea. Well, I'm convinced, and I think other people will be convinced if they pick up your book, Corinthian Wisdom, Stoic Philosophy, and the Ancient Economy. Dr. Tim Brookins, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.